job in the world to get a free badge to come here, and it's pretty cool. They're working really, really hard, so I'd like to give them all a round of applause for making our experience. In recent years, the legal defense fund's work fighting for the freedom to read and fighting against censorship has taken us into communities and libraries and classrooms where we're finding that the massive interest in the graphic novel form and comic book form that informs places like Comic-Con being in the absolute center of the pop culture universe is meaning that more and more people are wanting to access comics in schools and more people are going to want to access comics in libraries and communities. And as that happens, more and more challenges occur, and they are being combated by more and more experts that are coming in and scrutinizing the art form in a positive and constructive way about how we can advance our understanding and how we can advance our communities. And so old assumptions are being challenged, and new dynamics are being developed. And this afternoon, we're privileged to be discussing those dynamics with my good friend and a great CBLDF ally, Dr. Meryl Jaffe. Meryl, coming up.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us, and also thank you to the San Diego Comic-Con 2014
program team.
Before we introduce ourselves, I wanted to get a feel about you. I wanted to find out a little bit about you. So just raise your hands. How many here are aspiring authors? Okay, a few. Illustrators? Yes. Teachers?
Yes.
Librarians.
Yes.
Social workers.
No.
Okay. More tired souls whose souls are tired and just need a rest and are parked here. Welcome. One more question. How many of you are exhausted? That's it. Okay.
Well, she's tired as fuck to know.
Okay, and it's only Friday. Hopefully over the next 50 minutes, we'll entertain and invigorate you so you can go on and conquer. So first I thought we'd briefly introduce ourselves, and I'll start. My name is Meryl Jaffe. I have a doctorate in educational and school psychology. I work for Johns Hopkins University Center for Talented Youth Online Division, and I teach critical reading and visual literacy. And I have written using content area graphic texts for learning, really catchy title, Raising a Reader with CBLDF, and there are copies over here for you. And this is a wonderful book that can help empower you if you need to talk to your school boards, teachers, parents, whomever, about the value of graphic novels, which we know, but they don't always. And then Working with Librarians, another brochure. And do we have anything else, Charles?
The Banned Books Week Handbook.
Banned Books Week Handbook.
Which Betsy will talk about.
Okay, so that's me, and I'm going to have my panelists introduce themselves.
Thank you, Meryl. I'm totally going to embarrass her and say happy birthday to Meryl.
Happy birthday!
You've already heard from me. I'm Charles Brownstein. I'm the executive director of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund.
Hi, I'm Betsy Gomez. I'm the editorial director for the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. I am responsible for Banned Books Week and working with libraries and the editor behind that. I also edit the website, so any typos you find are my fault. And prior to working with CBLDF, I spent about 12 years in education as a textbook content editor and developer.
And just very briefly, Betsy's website work can be accessed not only at cbldf.org, but we have a free weekly email newsletter, which some of you might have gotten in your inbox today. And if you'd like to get it, come and sign up at our table, booth 1020.
1920.
1920.
I'm Jenny Holm, and that's my brother Matt Holm.
Hello.
And we're the co-creators of the Baby Mouse series and the Squish series, and we have a new book that just came out called Comic Squad Recess. And it's got contributions from a lot of other comic book creators that you might know, like Gene Yang and Dave Pilkey and Dan Santat. So swing by the booth. We're doing a signing tomorrow morning.
And I'm my name is Matt Down. I'm an author and illustrator. I've written three historical fiction graphic novels, Bluffton, Around the World, and Storm in the Barn. And also a picture book illustrator and chat books for readers.
And he's being very shy. He's nominated for an Eisner this year, so.
Not shy.
Okay, thank you very much. So first I thought we'd spend just a few, I just want to give an overview, and then we'll open it up to questions from the panel. But so first, graphic novels, Turbulent Past. In 1954, Frederick Wortham, a German-American psychiatrist, published Seduction of the Innocent, warning that comic books were a serious cause of juvenile delinquency. Its publication coincided with the U.S. Senate investigation on the same topic and resulted in the industry's self-regulated comics code authority. Horror, crime, and adventure comic genres were destroyed, and superhero comics survived at the expense of major changes to content and storylines. So with that, we're fast-forwarding to today, or close to today, and in 2013, Carol Tilley of the University of Illinois demonstrated that Wortham's research was poorly conceived, poorly executed, and just wrong. And Carol Tilley is going to be, has been and will continue to be on some of CBLDF's other panels, and you should check out some of her talks. But it's a given that violence is all around us, and it's obvious that we need to respond to this in how we raise our children. The top of our discussion today is whether graphic novels can play a role in that conversation. So I'm going to open up to questions to my esteemed panel. And the first question is, how has Wortham's Seduction of the Innocents affected the industry and your work in particular, if at all?
Okay. I guess the Seduction of the Innocent was a flashpoint of moral panic that preceding it involved the introduction of arguments that we still see to this day about any form of new media. Now, I'm fond of saying that the job of the younger generation is to horrify their elders.
And it's hard to embarrass them.
And our job is to embarrass them in retaliation for being horrified.
Yeah.
But also in terms of how we respond to being horrified, there's either you find a way to, access, the common ground, or there's a path to censorship. And so the arguments against comics that they were badly drawn, badly printed, and badly written, as Sterling North wrote in his 1940 editorial, A National Disgrace, or that they were a leading cause of juvenile delinquency, as Wortham discussed in his book, The Seduction of the Innocent, has echoed across time as we discuss, when I was growing up, heavy metal music, which, they said listening to Slayer was going to make me a bloodthirsty murderer, and instead it made me protect free speech, which might be worse. but you know what? The kids are all right. Or after that, my younger siblings, were into, rap music, and this was going to make them, completely violent, bloodthirsty misogynists. And like, well, no, absolutely not. My sister's a nurse practitioner and doing very well caring for other people. Or, people in this audience probably have to deal with video games being attacked as a causal media effect for violence. And so Wortham, I think, kind of was this flashpoint for this persistent moral panic that echoes down to this day and will continue to echo into the future, because every piece of new media has its detractors that just don't quite get why the kids are into this. But again, the kids are okay. To answer Meryl's question about how this winds up affecting us today is that there is still this lingering of stigma. After the Senate subcommittee hearings on comics and juvenile delinquency occurred, the industry was basically faced with a moral panic that said, you guys either need to clean up your act or the government's going to clean it up for you. And so that created this code that really dumbed down the content, you know, as kind of this self-defensive mechanism. But it also created a stigma where, as Carmine Infantino said to David Heyju in his excellent book, The 10-Cent Plague, if you went to a party and said that you were a comic book artist or you worked in comics, it was like saying you were a child molester. And so people, you know, altered, you know, people had this horrible dim view of comics, and that really persisted for about 50, 60 years. And so in terms of the popular culture space, thanks to things like Comic-Con raising awareness and appreciation of comics and placing us in an environment where comics are at the center of mass media, you know, the forward-looking folks, the pop culture folks, the movie folks are going, you know, right on, there's nothing wrong with comics, but there's still a lot of lingerings of that stigma, particularly amongst decision makers in certain education environments that say, no, comics are still bad, comics are still this problematic force. And so I think if any lingering of Wortham occurs, it's in that environment.
Anyone want to add? I mean, that was pretty...
That's pretty dark. I think one interesting thing is just seeing the sort of cycle of backlash as it continued on. You know, in the 80s, finally, sort of the comic code started to dissolve, and you had things like Watchmen and Dark Knight Returns, and people are saying, you know what, we can do more than just this dumbed-down comics, these comics that we've been forced to do all these years. We can do more adult things. And that sort of broke the floodgates, and then they're like, well, it's going to be all adult comics from now on. And so then that's kind of where, when we started creating our own comics, it was almost trying to say, like, okay, well, you know, when comics first started, you had comics for every demographic, every age group, every gender, you know. And now we got to this point where it's only very serious, very adult comics for men in their 30s or something. You know, that's sort of like what it was getting to be. And we were like, well, we liked reading comics when we were kids. Like, can't there be kids' comics again? And so I think now you're starting to see that reflowering of people are like, yeah, there can be comics for kids. And there can be comics that aren't about superheroes. You know, there can be comics that are about history and science and everything else.
I like that. When I was working as a picture book illustrator, I had this idea for my first book, and I thought I would do it as a graphic novel. This is like 2005. And I remember talking to an art director at a major publisher, and she said, forget it. Nobody does graphic novels for kids. Don't even think about it. So I said, oh, okay, no, I'm done. And a year later, Boney had come out. Or not Boney and Mac came out. Scholastic had taken Boney and toys and put it out for kids. And it was the teachers and the librarians that all of a sudden were saying, we want more books like this. So I already had this graphic novel thing ready to go because I've been waiting. He's like, no, you can't do it. And all of a sudden they're like, no, we want to make graphic novels for kids. So it's kind of ironic that from my perspective in the publishing world, it was the teachers and librarians saying, no, we want these. We want ones that are written for kids, which is kind of the pocket that we found ourselves in.
When you are creating your works, do you think about this? I mean, do you think about, well, the comic code is gone, but do you think about either taming down or not taming down violence or certain aspects of the story or not? If the story is the story and whatever it is, it is.
I'm definitely writing for a middle grade audience. I mean, that is who I'm going for, like 10, 14, 15. I want to write a book that teenagers would also like, or people in their 40s would like me. I'm writing a book that I would like, but I am conscious of that. That said, you can push it. You know, you can put in violence if it's justified, you know, and things like that. So it serves to the story. But you do have a little bit, because I'm writing for that age group, and that's who I want to, that's my audience.
I believe really strongly from a writing standpoint, just like writing for yourself initially, just doing something that from your gut, you're kind of your own audience to start out with. So I know that that's how I approached Rust, but I just did a book
your story in particular is about war. Or the ramifications or the effects of war.
Yeah, it is a fictional war with robots and stuff like that. But there's a little bit of war violence. I call it robot violence in there. It goes on. There were a couple of panels that I just had to pull back on just a little bit. When I knew it was going to be all, I probably just had to. But that was about it. Otherwise, I really believe in the complexity of the maturity of the emotions of kids of a lot of different ages. And that was actually just reiterated to me yesterday on a panel. I had some kids that wanted to pitch me their comic. And they were young. They were like 7 and 9, maybe. And they were showing me their drawings, and I said, what is this about? And it was a story about these kids that are abused by their parents, and they just went on to tell this really, kind of dark story, and I was just reminded that kids have complex emotions and maturity that we sometimes forget about. That doesn't mean that we should, just open the doors, but I think sometimes we're at risk of, watering them.
That brings up. Did you
want to
say something else?
Only that kids tend to be their own best censors. A lot of times, you'll find that kids, if they're not ready for something, they'll put it away. And whereas I think that we kind of visit our adult sensibilities on some work that they may not actually see. I'm sorry, go on.
No, it's okay. I was just going to piggyback on what you said, in that. I'm the educator. Well, Betsy's also the... Betsy and I are the token educators on the... not token, but we are the representatives of education on the panel. And graphic novels are great in terms of addressing social issues, anxieties, tension, violence in the home or in the playground or in the classroom or in the world around us. And we can really use graphic novels in the classroom to teach consequences, actions and their consequences, to teach kids how to break down an event, to better understand it. And you can also teach them in terms of having them write their own sequential art stories. We can help them deal with a lot of, learn to maybe find alternate means of expression that may be more effective for them to tell their stories and to try to better understand them.
Yeah. Just kind of a specific example would be Persepolis, and when Chicago Public Schools tried to ban it, Persepolis is a great book for kids to find ways to deal with violence, because there's so much violence in the book itself, and just kind of it's a background thing, and Chicago is one of our most violent cities, unfortunately, and a lot of these kids are facing it directly, a lot of them are facing it indirectly, and so it's something that'll help them deal with that.
And I think even as a medium, so we mostly write for younger audience, and Baby Mouse and Squish is really for a first to sixth grade level. So we're a bit lower than Matt's age level, but we're working on a new project that is more personally inspired about some how our lives were affected by drugs, and it's been very cathartic to work on this for me and Matt. He just kind of started. To just work through it. Stuff that I couldn't talk about when I was a kid, because I was the kid in the situation dealing with it. There was nobody to talk to about it. I'm kind of writing it for myself, my kid self, and hoping that a kid in the situation today would read it and feel a little bit better that they're not the only person that went through what we went through. So I wish I'd had something like that I could have read when I was a kid. So.
Okay, next question. If you had your druthers, is there anything in this industry that you actually want to tone down? All right.
I think for me, I wouldn't want to tone down anything, but I'd like to see more diversity. And it's not a matter of toning down things, but more diversity in subject matter, more diversity in creators. That's an ongoing conversation that comics is already having.
Right. So.
Yeah, I think maybe it's more turning it up than toning it down.
Okay, it's both ways.
Yeah, because we need, we're in this recovery period now where people are saying, oh, it's okay to make all these stories. It's okay for different kinds of people to make different kinds of stories. So I think as the years go by, we're just going to be building up that catalog of great stuff.
And to tie that into the historical point is that comics for 40, 50 years were really tamped down to this very niche environment that flourished in the direct sales market, and that's kind of where we went from the superhero fantasy exclusively into the graphic novel format and the diversity of stories and formats, and that kind of found purchase in the popular culture as the media adaptation, and in the library space kind of as the teen shelf, the YA shelf. But there's still a lot of growth to do both in the kid shelf and in the adult section as far as the library space is involved. So to Matt's point, it's a reflowering, and it's also the next step in kind of the corrective healing process from when Harvey Kurtzman in the 1950s was serializing a 7-part history of the Civil War in Two Fisted Tales that might have ended up being the first graphic novel, but that went away because of the code, changing the business dynamics. Now we're kind of seeing all of that promise that was there, getting to the stage where, we can be a medium for everybody again.
Yeah, that one thing that I think is, that everyone's saying, I look at this very positive time where we're seeing, like you said, more kinds of stories being put out there. And for me, it's my publisher is a traditional book publisher, so they were always going to publish my books as a graphic novel, so they don't have to rely on selling it as a monthly for people to buy it and then make it into a book. It's written to be a standalone book or a series as a book. And I think that actually opens it up to having, like you say, historical fiction or memoir for kids or any kind of thing, because that's what you don't have to worry about selling it on a month-to-month basis.
Right. Yeah. So it's not like waiting for TV ratings. Like, we're going to get canceled any second.
This is doing pretty well, so maybe we can turn it into a book. It's like, now we're starting as a book, and maybe it's going to do well. Maybe it's not, but maybe it'll find its audience. And I think because that's opening up, you'll get more different kinds of stories, and people like me that are coming in from the children's illustration part are making graphic novels now, and I know of others who are doing that too, or they're working on stuff that'll be out in the next couple of years, so you'll see more of that.
And your point about diversity of channels is really, really important, because for a very long period of time, comics was really a one-horse distribution method, whether it was the newsstand pre-1978, the direct sales market 78 through about 98, 99. And so now we live in this wonderful environment where, as you're saying, an alternative that works is this publishing, but also there's digital. Also, the comic book stores that survived the business contractions of the 90s are really welcoming places, and there's flowering of month-to-month comics. So there's a comic for just about every reader, and now we're getting sophisticated enough as a business to reach those readers wherever they want to reach the content.
I think the great thing about the comic industry is that it's driven by passion. It's not really driven by money.
We're getting better.
Yeah. I mean, this is a big convention. I'm not fooled. But the people that are making them are really doing it for the passion of it in a big way. And what that means is that we're just going to make what we love, what we want to make, and people are, that diversity in the comics will come out of the desire. It'll come naturally as an evolution, as opposed to big publishers saying we need to have a new crime drama for the age group or whatever. Like, that's not happening. It's just people are making stuff, and audience is occurring.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because just making these books is this like marathon. It's a colossal thing, and if you don't love it, you
won't do it.
It's just crazy. So, I think that's a really great point.
Okay, great. I touched upon the fact that having kids, whether you're a parent or a teacher, learn how to create sequential art stories to help them deal with issues or anxieties or things going on in the world around them. So for teachers who want to do that, parents who want to help their kids, and for aspiring authors, illustrators. There are clearly different ways to depict violence in text and images. And what tips or strategies might you share with us as we either struggle as creators or as people who want to teach kids how to create these sequential art stories? Any tips?
I mean, I think one tip, I have young kids, so I have a 10-year-old and a 7-year-old, and my 10-year-old is he's full of drama. he is the, if you look up tween in the dictionary, the kid's name is next to it. So, but he is a mad doodler, and so, and he loves to draw, and he was even one of these kids who had a really hard time sitting still in class in third and fourth grade. So his teacher said, he's always drawing, and she said, send in a notebook for him, and when he's wiggly or whatever, let him draw. And the kid would just fill these notebooks with doodles and cartoons, and I would read them afterwards, and, you know, they were very interesting. But yeah, I think that's good. Just let them work it out. It's not like an assignment. It's just like their own. It's the equivalent of, like, we had diaries when we were kids. Like, young girls were given diaries, which I never wrote in. I wish I'd just been given a doodle pad because I probably would have drawn pictures.
Less intimidating.
Yeah, instead of having to write a sentence. So.
That's my first book, Set for the Dust Bowl, and there's a sequence in it based on a real event where it's called Rabbit Drive, where people would herd in jackrabbits and club them to death if you're eating what was left around. And it's a very violent sequence, but it's important to the story. But I didn't want to show them, you know, I didn't want to see a rabbit get smashed or anything. But then I kind of came on kind of accidentally that, well, not showing it is less violent, but it's far more offensive. So I, you know, if you have a panel of someone lifting a club, the next panel is a rabbit, and the next panel I just had to color red. The reader fills all that in, and they don't see it, but it hits home. The violence is there, and they're also doing what kids, in my case, or anyone's doing, they're reading sequential comics, you're filling in the blanks. Yeah. You're putting this panel plus this equals, oh, four rabbits. But I don't show any of the rabbits being hit in the whole sequence. So for me, it was a way of not being violent because I didn't want to draw that. But also, it was the more effective way as a storytelling choice.
Yeah, that's really fascinating because I strongly believe in the theory of less is more. And yeah. So for us to approach the sequential storytelling in a way that is not gratuitous or that wouldn't affect kids negatively, it doesn't just mean, well, less blood.
Right.
Or less graphic image. It doesn't actually always mean that, so, because you can do something that's less, and it can have more impact than if you had drawn a really graphic scene.
Right.
Well, yeah, so it's not an easy sliding scale. There's complex decisions.
Yeah, like a more, I mean, obviously a more grown-up situation would be like the storytelling in Schindler's List. Like, you're following the girl in the red coat. You don't see her get murdered, but you see the red coat on the pile at the end, and you're like, oh my god, and that hits so much harder.
Well, Spielberg, you know, did show the shark. You know.
Right.
Not showing the shark. I mean, the shark didn't work. It's the reason he didn't show the shark. Not showing the shark in Jaws was, you know, great. That first hour of Jaws, when you don't see the shark, it's terrifying.
Okay, great. I just wanted to piggyback on what Jenny said. As a teacher, there were lots of students in my classroom who just couldn't sit still. And so what I did was I told them that instead of taking notes, they could doodle. But the doodles had to be on topic, and at the end of the class, we had a wall of fame, and we'd hang up the doodles. And once in a while, when it was quiet or if I felt the kids needed a break, we would talk about those doodles. It was reviewing the material. The students who needed to fidget or do something were doing something constructive. And it helped them better express what they were trying to do with the art.
Yeah, I totally experienced that. California history is like in the curriculum in fourth grade. And my son was supposed to be drawing. You're supposed to draw the state and where all the missions are, and he started to draw this cartoon of people falling, of California cracking, and people falling off the state and going, and like earthquakes and volcanoes. And it was kind of awesome.
It's funny, both those stories, because when I was in high school, I had the same experience where I spent a lot of my time in high school drawing, and I had a couple of teachers that were okay with it, but one in particular, who's my math teacher, and he said, you can draw if you want during class, but you know, it's great to be doing something on topic, but he would test me every now and then where I would be sitting there drawing and sitting there lecturing and say that those people that are listening will nod their heads.
Just to dust off that old textbook experience, one of the things that we always emphasize in the programs I worked on is journaling, because it enforces literacy. And, you know, journaling, the idea that, you know, you just think of the kids writing a paragraph, and some of the kids are not enthusiastic about that. They're just, yeah, I don't want to write a paragraph. They'll write three sentences or whatever the teacher says is the minimum. But with cartooning, if you let them doodle, if you let them draw in the journal as opposed to write, I think you're going to get something that, for a lot of the kids, is much more comprehensive, much more involved. They're going to understand the concepts better. And it's something that works across all subject areas. It's something, you know, if you're teaching a science class, tell them to draw it out. It's because words in science, intimidating, but pictures, not so much.
And not only that, but when you pair the what you're listening, what you're hearing, and possibly what you're reading with what you're drawing, that's creating additional memory association. So it's going to be easier to, hopefully, it should be easier to retrieve that information as well, because it is packaged in so many different ways.
And the other thing is, I remember from when I was in school, almost all of your assignments are write paragraphs of prose text about this subject. And I've written a lot of prose over the years, but it's not always the best way to communicate something or depict something. Like, which is better, writing, you know, an extremely long paragraph detailing all the different parts, all the organelles in a cell or something, mm-hmm. or is it better to draw a diagram with little labels that point out each separate thing and what they look like and where they are? I mean, that's much more actually effective, even though it's not, you know, writing it out. Like, the writing actually makes it harder to understand what you're trying to get at.
Well, I can tell you from personal experience, I got dropped into AP Biology earlier than I should have been, and I was having a hard time with photosynthesis, and so I grabbed every textbook I could. My teacher had a bunch of extra ones and just redrew every diagram that they had in the textbook, and that's how I learned it.
That's a neat idea. Okay, next question. What graphic novels might you suggest for parents and teachers who want to help kids deal with issues of violence and tolerance in their lives?
There's a lot.
Do you want me to let you think about that for a minute?
Yeah.
Okay, and I'll go to another question,
okay.
And we'll come back. This is not a test.
Okay.
Anecdotes that you collected from your school visits, from author readings, drawings, on graphic novels, violence, and tolerance?
I mean, I don't think I haven't had like a violent thing, but with younger kids, you know, with elementary school kids, they're violent with each other, but in a more of a bullying way. We see it as less violent.
Emotional violence.
Emotional violence, and we have a character in one of our books, Felicia, who's a cat, who's like the mean girl, and it sort of torments Baby Mouse. And I've had many girls come up to me at many schools over the last 10 years and say, I have a Felicia in my life. What should I do? You know, I don't know how to deal with this. So, and it seems like, oh, you'll grow through it. You'll realize that she's not a good friend, and it's easy to say as a grown-up, oh, you'll get past this. But, you know, when you're like 7 years old, that's your entire life, like, dealing with that. And I think, so it's a good way, it's like a good springboard to talk about what makes a good friend. And is this kid going too far? Do you need to bring in an adult to help out a little bit? So.
And I think the first issue of Baby Mouse, you talk, it's really about who your friends are.
Yeah, about finding your friends.
And so that would be, if a child was having a question about that, I think it's a really wonderful way to kind of talk to your kids. So that would be one example.
Yeah, and it's interesting to hear. Obviously, there, like you, I've had those experiences too, but I've also had the experiences where, in the books, Baby Mouse, she knows that Felicia is not her friend, but whenever Felicia acts like her friend, she's like, oh, I really could be her friend. This could work out. I could become popular too. And so she keeps wanting to go back, and the kids are like, doesn't she know she's bad? Like, why doesn't she just stay away? I'm like, because that's what's going to happen to you, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, just remember this when that girl is there who you thought was mean to you, but then she starts being really nice to you for some reason. Like, put your radar up. You know? It's like you just might find yourself falling into that same trap again, because we've all done that.
The anecdotes I've collected are a little bit more scary, and it actually kind of would be a good question for you, Meryl. You know, in this era of, you know, zero tolerance policies in schools and true threat, you know, sensibilities, you know, I've encountered a lot of cases where kids that are doodling or journaling are actually, you know, called to task because they're drawing violent images in their private notebooks, or they're drawing violent images because they're channeling whatever is there. And so there's this, you know, certain combat between this sense of art being a safe space to confront and channel these emotions, but then there's also this, you know, compelling interest on behalf of schools in safety. And I've seen kids get stuck in the crossfire. There's a case that occurred in New Jersey last year where a kid was kicked out of school for more than a year for drawing doodles, including, you know, this device called the poofer, which was like this flame-throwing thing, and, you know, wrote in the name of his principal who he wanted to, you know, burn up with this, and he was kicked out of school because this was interpreted as a threat. Now, I don't know if there were other issues involved. Usually these things aren't black and white, but, you know, there is this kind of dissonance between what we're saying here, and I agree with this, that art is a safe place, but how do we create this sense of, you know, awareness so that we can also protect kids, but also not ostracize them for expressing themselves. And I'm not sure.
That's a super point.
So complex. Really, yeah.
My response as a school psychologist educator is that zero tolerance is a great idea, but there are so many shades of gray that it doesn't really work. And research finds that in a lot of these horrible, horrible incidents of violence in the schools, there were cues that these kids were given, both whether it was drawing or whether it was saying to a friend, "Oh, I'm going to get what's his name or what's her name," and by silencing that, we're not going to be getting those cues and clues. And so, on the one hand, maybe we shouldn't, but we don't want to scare other kids in the classroom. So we need to have conversations, maybe, about what's acceptable in class and what's not acceptable. And the other thing is that gray area. I have one of my kids was being bullied for years. And I didn't know about it because my child didn't tell me. And we switched schools, and it seemed that one of the kids who was bullying him, one of the people who was bullying my child, I'll get to you, if you have a question, I'll get to you in a few minutes, transferred also. And no one knew about this because my child wasn't telling us. And one day in school, I get a call from the principal saying, "We're suspending your child because your child punched this kid in the face." And it turned out that no one asked my child what was happening. And this other kid who was transferred with my son had been pushing him and punching him all day, and no one saw it because this kid was a really good bully. He was doing it when no one was looking. And my son would walk away, and the bully would follow, and he'd walk away, and finally my son just turned around and punched him. But it was a zero-tolerance school. So my son was suspended, but the bully, who no one saw hitting him and pushing him and following him all day long, nothing happened. Yeah. So there's a personal anecdote. It's a big problem, I think. And I think it gets back to tolerance. I think we have to teach tolerance. And maybe having kids draw and express and learn to communicate. A lot of the violent altercations in school and out of school are because kids don't know how to communicate. Or they feel people aren't listening to them. And so maybe what we have to do is open up and teach better channels of communication. And I've spoken way too long.
I just one quick one to end. I was teaching like a workshop of comics for some kids, and we were taking a scene. Red Riding Hood, I said, "What is Red Riding Hood?" And I said, "It's just the moment where Red's in the woods and she hears the wolf." And I'm showing you the way I do the process, where I write it out first and then a thumbnail. So we're doing that. So we wrote out a couple sentences. You know, Red's, here's a twig branch. You know, the wolf is there. You know. And I was letting the kids come up, and I was having them draw the panels and then draw a quick little doodle. So if they didn't draw, you know, they could just do that. And some kids were drawing their own. And, of course, half the boys were drawing these incredibly graphic, you know, the real ripping red pieces. You just kind of let them do that, you know, because they'd have these drawings. You'd see them in the back, the one with all the red crayon going like that. And I showed them that stuff, and I'm like, okay, that's cool, you got that kind of going on. But then I had them come up to the board and draw a panel and do a thing. And it was the panel of the wolf, you know, it just says the wolf. And this little girl, she's in the third grade. This is actually something that just showed me this really violent drawing to get. She came up, and to draw the panel for the wolf, she shaped it like a fang. Like the panel was an upside down triangle. And then she drew the wolf in. And I was just like, whoa, hold on, everybody. And then I got all the kids, even the kids drawing the most like blood-soaked picture. They all said, "That's cool what she just did," you know, because she shaped the panel like the, you know, the violence. So I was letting them do all whatever they wanted to do, but when some kid did something that's alternative and cool, they all thought that was cool too. So then we all kind of came back onto the same page. But you let them draw. You know, there's always going to be boys drawing incredible man.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, you can't do that. I mean, with, you know, everyone write crayons down, it would just be no good.
Yeah, it really is a, like, talk about journaling, like sketch journaling. That really is true. And I don't think I was even cognizant of that, but like as a child, I had a sketchbook that I was very embarrassed to show to people. And it was because I would explore like these really violent images because it was interesting to me as a little boy, you know. And I didn't like showing that to my mom, so I was afraid she'd get angry at me. I wasn't a violent kid, I was pretty quiet, I think, but those were my opportunities to just kind of explore and let my brain and my imagination take over. And it's hard, it would probably be hard for educators and for parents to get to that point where you don't take it too seriously or you just kind of let them do their thing. But I do think there's quite a bit of value in it.
Right. You can channel it, you know.
Yeah.
And as adults, we need to monitor. Of course, if we continue to see violent drawings and cues and people are bragging about, oh, I'm going to... Then we have to intervene. But there's so many gray areas. And when my son came home, he was crying, not because he was hurt or suspended, but because he had to hurt somebody. But the kid never bothered him again. Anyway, we're getting close to the end of the panel. Before we open up to your questions, you have been so patient. Would you like to share anything about what's coming out next in your lives that we can breathlessly anticipate?
I have a new novel. It's science fiction, and it's called The 14th Goldfish, and it comes out in August from Random House Children's Books.
It's awesome. It's great.
It's
really good. Thanks.
I have a picture book coming out for very young kids called Druthers. It's a book called Druthers came out in September, and I'm just starting the final arc of my next graphic novel, which comes out in 2016, and it's a retelling of Snow White set in 1933 Manhattan. Something Snow White, like a film noir.
Oh, that sounds cool.
2016 is when it's supposedly going to be out.
That's a long way.
I'll be drawing every day. There's a lot of drawings.
Not for comics, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's actually pretty fast, yeah.
I can't already mention it. Russ consumes my life because it's not my day job. So Volume 3 is kind of the newest book in the series. Luckily, I haven't picked it up yet. Volume 4 is probably a long ways away, maybe like 2016. My wife and I just had a new baby, so.
Yeah. A really cute baby, too.
So I'm drawing around a little slowly.
Okay, so thank you guys, and this woman in the back has been waiting so patiently.
Imagine what it would be like. Like I would find that job to be very, very difficult to be in that situation where all the kids are drawing Red Riding Hood, and a couple of the boys draw Red Riding Hood torn to bits, and it's like, okay, I guess we're going to put that up on the wall, too. Because, it's kind of important. And maybe there's, like, some methods of talking about it, or talking about the decision-making, or are you just looking to shock your classmates, or whatever, you know. But there is a path there. I'm not sure what it is, and that's why I'm not a teacher. But I think it's an important path.
Woman in the back.
Andy Runton.
Thank you. Sorry, I love Andy. I've been using all the time. Andy Runton is Owly. And it's like very sparse on words, or void of words. It's just pictures, and it's great stories and great characters. Really, really good.
And Scott Robbins, he has a book out called A Parent's Guide to the Best Kids Comics that goes through dozens and dozens and dozens of titles and tells you about them. So as someone who's building a collection, you can actually have an idea of what these are,
it's
what
really
ages they're appropriate
yeah.
for. It's a really good handbook to have to just sort of sort through them all.
And he's a librarian, too. Yeah. He's very active on like Twitter and things like that. There's a whole series of like, bunch of librarians on Twitter and things like that talking and trading titles for kids' comics. So that's something to tap into. And Scott Robbins would be a good way to kind of get into that.
I just want to add that these titles that you guys have mentioned, they are for like younger and middle readers, but they're really for all readers.
Yeah.
Baby Mouse is definitely, and Swish is definitely one of them. And I would add Amelia, the Amelia Rules books by Jimmy Gallery.
Yes, they're great.
For middle school and middle school, I guess. Yeah. Also, they're great, but they're really, they're all ages because they're just so smart.
So, and I would put in a shameless plug for visiting the cbldf.org website. Meryl is writing a great series for us called Using Graphic Novels. We tend to cite what age group's appropriate for the books. And we're also working on a series of discussion guides, and we cite the age groups in those as well. And if you want to come talk to me after the panel, I'll give you my email address, and I might be able to hook you up with some librarians who've done a lot of development.
Yeah, there's a big library of material that you can get for free on cbldf.org, and you know, we strive to make these resources more and better. So if you see areas to improve, please talk to Betsy, and also please explore, because there's a lot of really great recommendations and resources there.
And thank you for adding the program to your library.
You're
the reason it's, you know, that we're in such a great game.
Plug, if you're planning a banned books week event, definitely grab a copy of this before you leave. We got some free ones up here. It's got some ideas for events that you can do in your library, and it might give you some ideas for how you can develop your collection.
And I think I'm still 5 minutes. Do you have a question?
There's 6,000 people ready to talk watch Hunger Games. It's the 12-year-old kids killing kids, and they can read about it. And then they can see it when it, it changes the rating. But again, they're reading it. But when it comes to the visual articulation of what's going on and how difficult that is to do, because you read it, I think everybody, the parents are fine with having them read it. But when it comes to drawing it, all of a sudden, all the flags start coming up. And how do we teach the teachers and the admin about what they're trying to express in a visual way when it's apparently easy to do or loaded when it's in the written word? The question is, how do we train the teachers and the admin that what the kids are expressing and the feelings that they're having, things that they've been thinking about since they were 5, 12, 22? Do you understand my question?
It's definitely, that's, I think, one of the unique problems comics have always had is that as a visual medium, it's you can quickly take in information. And so, whereas a scene of graphic violence or graphic sex or something hidden in pages and pages of prose will be there, with a graphic novel, if you open it up to the wrong page, the wrong parent or adult sees it, they're like,
Or the right one.
then suddenly, in 1 second, they see it outside of any context. And of course, images do hit people harder, You hear about all of the stuff that's happening, in Syria or Ukraine or something, but they show one photo from an AP photographer over there, and then suddenly people's minds are just totally changed about subjects. So visuals are very powerful. And I'm not sure what the solution there is.
Well, I think the solution is to, A, encourage dialogue about the content, and also to emphasize that work has to be taken as a whole. A prose book is really only as filthy as your own mind. And in, some cases, like the lady who's trying to ban the Absolutely True Diary of the Part-Time Indian, she must have a really filthy mind because she keeps trying to get it banned over and over and over again, even though it's been celebrated all over the United States. But comics, really have to be taken as a whole. And we're lying to ourselves if we think that our kids are going to be irreparably tarnished because they access, in your case, a violent image that perhaps is adapted from something like The Hunger Games, or in another instance, a panel of nudity from, Watchmen, which we get complaints about frequently because there's a naked blue guy in it. You've got to take it as a whole. And as you point out, we live in an era of visual information, and we live in an era where nobody over 25 has any idea what it's like to be under 25, where they're growing up with these things in their pockets and they're bombarded by those imageries. So I think, the solution is tolerance, dialogue, and considering the materials as a whole, which almost every development policy should consider when books are banned or challenged, to really consider, what's the bigger context here, as opposed to that, hammer hit my knee and I kicked, which is where I think a lot of the bans tend to come in.
Our time is up. I want to thank you all for joining us. I want to thank my panelists.